It's a Tuesday edition of the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. Welcome and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Taylor Charleston will be in with a feature report, and I'll have a look at regional and national agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news, right after this word from our sponsor.
AgroPlante is the leading manufacturer in specialty products. AgroPlante formulates products that rise to the challenge of today's growing conditions. Saline and sodic soils reduce crop yield and cause significant crop losses. AgroPlante developed Cation EX5 Plus with growers in mind to manage soil salinity. With multiple years of research, Cation EX5 Plus has proven to be an excellent source of calcium and an effective soil salinity manager. Run it through drip irrigation without any issues. Simplify your application method with innovative and efficient formulations. Alleviate salinity stress with Cation EX5 Plus. AgroPlante, imagination, innovation, science in action.
At the University of California, Davis are releasing five new strawberry varieties developed to resist the soil-borne disease Fusarium wilt. Researchers said this marks the first release from the UC Davis strawberry breeding program where all cultivars have Fusarium wilt resistance. They also said the new varieties will have high yields and improved fruit quality. In California, 1.8 billion pounds of strawberries are harvested each year. This year's first male flight of California Red Scale is noticeably later than in prior years, according to Sandeep Aggawadam, Area Citrus Integrated Pest Management Advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension. The cold and wet winter has had a notable impact on pest populations. Usually March 1st is tentatively the first time they see the first male flight in Kern County. In Tulare, Fresno, and Madera counties, things happen 10 to 14 days after what they see in Kern County, he said. This year, they got a notice that they saw the first biofix on April 9th, which is more than 5 weeks later than the warmer years. What that means is that the first generation, which would usually come by the first week of May, is going to come later in the year. Flooding concerns are mounting across California as rising temperatures begin to melt the massive snowpack from the state's extreme winter. Many areas of the state received 700 inches of snow in total over the winter season, but the melting snowpack is posing a serious flooding threat to central California. The area of concern is Tulare Lake, located south of Fresno, which has returned for the first time in more than 25 years. It was once the largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi River. Snowmelt from the Sierra Nevada would naturally fill the lake every winter up until the early 1990s when rivers were dammed for irrigation purposes. Now there are agricultural fields that are underwater with plenty of snow that has yet to melt. A reservoir upstream is expected to get three times its capacity in the next couple of months, meaning towns near the lake and along the rivers and streams that lead to the lake are facing dangerous flooding threats. California State climatologist Michael Anderson warned that rising temperatures will speed up the snowmelt and double the amount of water flowing into some of the state's reservoirs. Water managers will determine whether they need to release more water from reservoirs, but most residential communities are not expected to see immediate flooding due to the warming trend, he said. South of Yosemite, some rural communities and low-lying areas are bracing for possible flooding. Residents in the Island District of Kings County have reactivated a crisis network to help each other prepare for rising waters. Meanwhile, the nearby city of Corcoran is adding to the top of a levee to try to keep water out. Much of the water has been channeled to an agricultural basin, recreating a vast lake that vanished during years of drought. More than 1 million TEUs per year have shifted away from U.S. West Coast ports, with Gulf of Mexico ports being the big winners, according to a report by Descartes Systems Group. The analysis of the shift in U.S. import volume since 2021 found that the days of long queues to get into the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, driven by a pandemic-related surge in demand for goods, has gone into reverse, with concerns about labor disputes on the Southern California ports leading to shippers choosing instead to deliver to ports such as Houston. Asian-based imports contributed to the most volume growth at Gulf Coast ports. However, the report also indicated that a smaller shift away from Northern European container imports was occurring simultaneously. Chris Jones with Descartes says that shifts in container import volumes from West Coast ports are top of mind again with the protracted contract negotiations. East and Gulf Coast ports have generally outperformed West Coast ports in terms of growth rates for the past several years amid a steady eastward shift of inbound cargo volumes that began with the expansion of the Panama Canal in late 2016. The structural nature of this shift was accelerated by port congestion and growing uncertainty surrounding negotiations between West Coast port employers and dock worker unions. Descartes said that changing trade lanes is not a trivial activity. However, the degree of volume shift that occurred in a short time frame during the pandemic is a testament to the ingenuity of logistics professionals. Seeds for Bees encourages the use of cover crops to increase the density, diversity, and duration of bee forage in California orchards, farms, and vineyards while improving soil health. This seed mix is available through Seeds for Bees, are designed to bloom at critical times of the year when natural forage is scarce but managed and native bees are active. Seeds for Bees serves the needs of bees, beekeepers, and growers, increasing sustainability of pollination and agriculture, according to the organization. Open enrollment for the program is June 1st through August 31st. Seed availability is limited and growers are encouraged to apply early. The first year Seeds for Bees enrollees are eligible for a $2,500 discount off their total seed purchase. Second year enrollees are eligible for a $1,500 discount off their total seed purchase. Shipping is free for all orders throughout the enrollees' participation in Seeds for Bees. Growers located within 50 miles of a seed distributor are requested to pick up their seed if possible, so more donations can go directly to growers for free seed. There are a limited number of new enrollees that will be accepted each year based on available funding. To be enrolled in the program, you must be a farmer or grower of crops in California. Complete an application, grow honeybee pollinated crops, including seed production for nuts or fruits, and growers of wind pollinated crops may also be considered for enrollment based on additional information provided in a grower's application. You must plant a minimum of 2 acres of cover crops, agree to submit 2 photos per year, and complete a short annual survey. And a short consultation with the Seeds for Bees program manager is required as the last step to finalize a participant's enrollment if accepted. For more information, contact the Director of Habitat Programs, Rory Crowley, by calling 916-287-3035 extension 1, or you can go to projectapism.org. Church Brothers Farms has announced it has hired Michelin Medina as Director of Sustainability and Corporate Engagement. Medina has more than 16 years' experience in the produce industry, acting in both business development and marketing roles. She most recently served as Senior Business Development Manager at Bunzel USA Destiny Packaging, where she worked closely with customers and her supply chain to source and develop innovative and sustainable packing solutions.
A healthy soil plays a key role in a plant's defense to multiple challenges in the environment, both biotic and abiotic stressors. UC Riverside researcher Philippe Rohlhausen is looking at the plant pathology side of this in citrus, where there's an emphasis for this method to combat Huanglongbing. Rohlhausen said research is looking at these issues from probiotic and prebiotic perspectives, much like what is observed in humans. But he is focusing on the probiotic, things like biopesticides or biofertilizers that associate with mycorrhizae.
Over 75% of plants are associated with mycorrhizae. And so this is a very important organism. This is a symbiotic organism between plant and a fungus, where the fungus helps the plant absorb water and nutrients, and also help the plant with like the defense against pathogen. And in return, the plants give the fungus carbon, so photoassimilated carbon. And so so we've looked at this, especially in the case of citrus and citrus Huanglongbing, because what we've seen is that usually in Florida, because we, you know, in California, the disease has not been established itself yet in commercial production. So in Florida, what we see is that the healthier tree are commonly associated with mycorrhizae. And so what we think is that basically the mycorrhizae help the plant cope with stress and especially fight off some of the soil-borne pathogens. So the Huanglongbing pathosystem is interesting because it is a disease caused by the bacterial agent, Candidatis liberibacteria asiaticus. But what we also understand now is that other pathogen causes stresses to the tree, and specifically soil-borne pathogen, they are weakened the tree and expose the tree to Huanglongbing disease, make it more susceptible to Huanglongbing disease. So If you could fight off those soil-borne pathogen, then you make the tree more tolerant to Wong Long Bing disease indirectly. And so this is what we're starting to understand. And so anything that would support the health or the presence of mycorrhizae in the soil would be beneficial to the tree long term. So it's not going to save the tree from Wong Long Bing disease, right? But this is going to expand the lifespan of an orchard by 2, 3 years, maybe or more. And this can be critical for when you talk about economics for citrus production. And so that's what we're looking at. And so now our focus is more on root health in that matter, because and how we can support the presence of mycorrhizae and other organisms that I didn't talk about in my talk, but there's others as well. And so anything that's soil amendments, for instance, cover crops and such can help really with the health of the root system of the tree and then cope with Wong Long Bing.
While some similar methods target specific microbial species and other crops to address plant stress, the method Rolshausen is referring to targets the entire microbial community to facilitate an all-around healthy soil.
When we look at mycorrhizae, there's actually several taxonomic group associated with citrus. So it's not one that's really specific. There's major groups, but we're really looking at the community here. But there's also other organisms like bacterium that are very interesting because they help with phosphate or nitrogen assimilation. Some of those bacteria are also very interesting for other reasons, and we don't always understand what those reasons are. When we sequence microbial communities associated with tree, we can really see which one are beneficial based on filtering processes that we apply to our sequencing data. But now we're at the stage where we go back and try to understand the biological function of those individual organisms. And so in our research, this is where we are now. And now that we have identified the potential beneficial ones, it's like, well, what do they do to those trees? And try to understand that a little better.
The goal is for good efficacy with biopesticides and biofertilizers, but these aren't fix-all solutions to a stressor, especially one like Wong Long Bing.
When you talk biocontrol, biofertilizer, it's not a silver bullet by any means. So you're never going to get 100% disease control, just like you do with synthetic chemistry. But there is no the benefit of those organisms is that there's no resistance to it. So like in a pathogenic population, there's no resistance that can develop. So it is, like you said, integrated in IPM programs or IPDM program in integrated pest and disease management. And so where we could reduce chemical input in the environment. And I think this is where the benefits of those is that we're trying to move away from synthetic chemistries or use less of it. I don't think it's realistic to think that we will not use any because we do need, synthetic chemistry to fight some of those diseases. But the idea is to try to reduce the amount that we use and replace them with some of those beneficial organisms that we see, biopesticides and biofertilizers.
This research and product type will look to meet increasing demands for the future regarding consumer desire for organic products and grower desire to use and spend less on traditional pesticides. For my AgLife, I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
Colorado became the first state to ensure farmers can fix their own equipment with the governor's signing of the Right to Repair law, which forces manufacturers to provide the necessary manuals, tools, parts, and software. Colorado took the lead on the issue after a national outcry from farmers that manufacturers prevent them from fixing their own machines. Farmers say it forces them to wait precious days for a servicer to arrive, a delay that could mean a hailstorm decimates a crop or a farmer misses the ideal planting window. Lawmakers in at least 10 other states have introduced similar legislation, including Florida, Maryland, Missouri, New Jersey, Texas, and Vermont. Colorado Democratic Governor Jared Polis signed the bill after the legislation advanced through the long committee hearings, having been propelled forward mostly by Democrats, even though a Republican lawmaker co-sponsored the bill. Manufacturers and dealers raised concerns that providing tools and information to farmers would allow equipment owners to illegally crank up the horsepower and bypass emissions control, putting operator safety and the environment at risk. They also argued that the law would expose companies' trade secrets. Precision agriculture is getting a boost from the U.S. House of Representatives. The Precision Agriculture Satellite Connectivity Act is one of a series of bills that the House is advancing to improve satellite services. Communications and Technology Subcommittee Chair Bob Latta of Ohio.
It's essential we bring our satellite laws and regulations into the 21st century, especially as we compete against other countries like China, who seek to dominate the United States.
Latta and Subcommittee Ranking Democrat Robin Kelly of Illinois are homing in on satellites to boost precision agriculture.
Our bill would require the Federal Communications Commission to look at its rules and submit recommendations, if any, on how it could update its rules to promote precision agriculture to help our farmers increase productivity and improve efficiency in their operations.
The FCC would have 15 months from the date of the bill's enactment to report its findings to the relevant House and Senate committees. Separate legislation is advancing through the Senate that would require the FCC to streamline licensing of commercial satellite communications, also key, Latta says, to boosting U.S. innovation and securing its networks. Fendt is testing a new Sense and Act weed management system that it aims to release commercially in 2024 in the Americas and Europe. Sold under the Smart Spraying moniker, the technology is to be a factory-installed option on Fendt's Rogator sprayers. Smart Spraying, targeting only weeds in fallow fields or in fields with growing crops in daylight and night, will be the result of a two-year partnership between Bosch BASF Smart Farming Joint Venture and AGCO. Agencies within the Farm Production and Conservation Mission Area of USDA are working jointly to streamline aspects of a producer's farm safety net. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
What are examples of how USDA's Farm Production and Conservation Mission Area, specifically its Farm Service Agency and Risk Management Agency, work together to balance both ad hoc disaster assistance and crop insurance as farm safety net tools? FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau at the North American Agricultural Journalist annual meeting this week discussed formation of the Emergency Relief Program.
One of the things we heard from farmers very early on, why do you need the same information that we gave to the crop insurance provider? And we heeded that, and we built a very streamlined approach for the delivery of that disaster assistance by partnering with our sister agency. And I think that it was mutually beneficial to us and them, because part two of this is helping get more folks aware of risk management strategies and having them leverage that to their benefit, because there's a linkage requirement built in there.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service has released its second annual National Industrial Hemp Survey. Rocky Mountain Regional Field Office Director Roger Ott says compared to last year, there are big changes in the 2022 report.
There were 28,300 acres of hemp grown in the open with 18,300 acres harvested. By comparison, in 2021, there were 54,100 acres of hemp grown in the open with 33,500 acres harvested. So that's a decrease of 38% in planted acreage and a decrease of 36% in harvested acreage. In 2022, the value of hemp production in open and under protection in the U.S. totaled $238 million, down 71% from 2021. So some big changes in that industry as growers either decided not to continue producing hemp or trying to grow hemp, and changes in the market and demand.
While the report does not provide a reason for the abrupt industry drop-off, Jonathan Miller, general counsel for the U.S. Hemp Roundtable, said in an email blast that the economic opportunity for U.S. farmers continues to decline, with the chief culprit being the Food and Drug Administration's inaction on regulating hemp extracts such as CBD. In January, FDA said that after years of review since hemp and its derivatives like CBD were legalized under the 2018 Farm Bill, it determined there is not a regulatory pathway in place to enact rules allowing the hemp to be marketed as a food item or dietary supplement. The agency said congressional action is needed to develop CBD regulations. Most retail fertilizer prices continue to shift lower the third week of April, according to retailers tracked by DTN. However, for the first time in several months, multiple fertilizers were slightly higher. The six fertilizers were all slightly lower compared to last month. Potash at an average price of $643 a ton, urea at $626, 10340 at $740, anhydrous at $995, UAN 28 at $423, and UAN 32 at $507 a ton. Multiple fertilizers were higher in price for the first time since the fourth week of November of 2022. DAP and MAP were both up just slightly, with DAP having an average price of $826 a ton, MAP at $812 a ton. Data from the USDA Economic Research Service says the acres of land and farms continues in a downward trend, with 893 million acres in 2022, down from 915 million 10 years ago.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.